Good afternoon. May I please the court? My name is Tracy Renner, number 27242, and I'm here this afternoon on behalf of Mark Walden, who is serving a life without parole sentence for felony murder. Felony murder requires proof that a person committed one of the enumerated felonies and that a death occurred while the person was either committing, furthering, or fleeing from that felony. Colorado law recognizes that for felony murder, the intent to kill is imputed from the intent to commit an inherently dangerous felony. Also, Colorado law recognizes that the intent must be formed either before or concurrent with the killing act. Otherwise, the deterrent purpose of felony murder does not apply.
And Ms. Renner, what specific case law do you rely on for that statement that you just made?
Well, Your Honor, it flows through the Cottrell, Braxton, and Phillips case. I think if you look at Phillips, which is one of the more recent cases where they considered sufficiency of the evidence, the court there specifically found that the evidence was sufficient. I think the concluding remark was it was sufficient to find that there was intent to commit the felony prior to or concurrent with the killing act.
Ms. Renner, if you take these trifecta of cases and say that creates this law, how could that be plain to the trial court or obvious if there's no one case that sets forth that proposition?
Well, it's certainly clear in Cottrell, and the court's presumed to know the law that exists. It's clear that in Cottrell, that proposition is advanced, and it says in the case that the state does not, or the people in that case, did not dispute that. The Braxton case comes then from Cottrell, and Braxton doesn't necessarily talk about it. But there's not a case in Colorado that specifically says there must be this intent to commit the felony either prior to or committed with the killing act. But it's implied in the cases that address sufficiency of the evidence, and I think the Phillips case is probably the best example of that. It's clear that is that Colorado, while it may not have expressly said it's adopted the majority view, that is how the cases have addressed the issue.
Ms. Renner, is part of your argument the notion, how could it be otherwise?
That, yes.
I mean, here the jury obviously wants to know. And once the jury makes that known to counsel and the judge, I take it your argument is the judge had an obligation to give an instruction that said it can't be otherwise.
Yes. And I think what happened in this case, the question from the jury throughout this case was this question of the sequence of events and whether that made a difference or not. The prosecution was trying to argue it did not make a difference based on the Braxton case that says the sequence of events does not make a difference as long as the felony is committed, or as long as the death occurs during the commission of the felony. But what was never made clear to the jury is that the intent to commit that felony has to be formed either prior to or concurrent with the killing act. I think also it's important to note in this case that when the court received the question from the jury, part of the question was, does robbery have to occur in any particular order? In other words, if he took money after he shot Mr. Frazier, is that still considered robbery? And the court interpreted this solely as a question about robbery. I think that was error, because clearly throughout the theme of closing argument was it doesn't make any difference whether the killing happened first or the taking of this money. And defense counsel, in discussing the court's answer to this question, did ask the court to include in its answer what it talks about in Bartoszewski, that the force that is used must be used to affect the taking. It's not just force and then a taking equals robbery. There has to be some evidence that the force that was used was intended to be used to take the property.
And this was during the discussion of how to respond to the jury question.
Yes, it was one of the final things that defense counsel asked for. So that too would have, had the court explained to the jury that not only because they were asking about whether taking the money from the floor of the car, whether it was the ground or the floor of the car, was sufficient to be from the presence of Mr. Frazier. And the court looked to Bartoszewski and answered that question that yes, that is from, because it, taking the language from Bartoszewski that but for the defendant's conduct, Mr. Frazier would have been able to regain control of that property. And what Bartoszewski also said, and what defense counsel asked for here, is that also that force must have been employed to effect the taking. So that would have been another way that the court could have explained to this jury that it was insufficient here for a theft to occur, that there had to be some intent to harm Mr. Frazier in order to take this money. And of course, so my position is there was insufficient evidence for all of the reasons that I set forth in the briefs. I mean, it didn't make any sense. There was no intent to rob. The evidence established there was a killing act. The evidence established, and in fact, the jury found this was a knowing act. They also found second-degree murder. There was a theft, but it did not establish an intent to rob Mr. Frazier. It did not establish that the force used here was to effect a taking. And then the jury was not properly instructed about those principles. The jury was never told that you had to find an intent to commit the robbery either prior to or concurrent with the killing act. And there wasn't any evidence here to support that. The evidence was that Mr. Walden shot Mr. Frazier while they were sitting in the car together, and in a panic afterwards picked up $100 and left, leaving $1,000 in the console of the car, 2 gallon baggies of marijuana in the car, and over $1,000 on Mr. Frazier's person. And I know the state has taken the position that perhaps this was a robbery gone bad, that he couldn't get what he had, that he intended to rob him. All of this is pure speculation. And in fact, the fact that they were being followed by Mr. Frazier's cousin and another gentleman in a car, and Mr. Walden knew that, he knew this car was following them into the parking lot, it was broad daylight. All of those things mitigate against any finding that there was intent to rob here. And in fact, it would be completely speculative to.
Had those two other people in the car behind him taken off before the shot was fired? I just don't remember the sequence of when the pursuers took off.
They saw Mr. Frazier fall out of the car, and they immediately took off.
Got it.
So there was nothing preventing Mr. Walden, had it been his intent to rob Mr. Frazier, from going through the console of the car, taking that money, or going through Mr. Frazier's pockets and taking the over $1,000 that was in his pockets. Instead, he grabbed $100 and ran and took the bus to Grand Rapids, Michigan. If the court doesn't have any further questions, I'm going to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
All right, Ms. Hunter. Mr. Michaels, isn't there some evidence here that the robbery was an afterthought?
I don't think that's the standard that we need to be evaluating this under, under a sufficiency of the evidence standard. But before I get to that, let me just state my name for the record.
So, oh, I'm sorry.
No, that's my fault. My name is Joseph Michaels, Registered Registration Number 40403, on behalf of the people of the state of Colorado. To jump right into it, I think there is an interpretation that could say it was an impulsive taking, but that's not the issue, and that's not the resolution of this case.
Well, I agree with the notion that it's not the issue for purposes of sufficiency.
Sure.
But the question I have is, once the jury makes it known that they're concerned about the timing, if there's some evidence that it's an afterthought, isn't it incumbent upon the judge to give an instruction that says, look, you're going to have to borrow this intent to make this a first-degree murder. And so you're going to have to show that the intent was there before the killing.
I don't think so in this case, because the instructions as given, the felony murder instruction, the robbery instruction, the aggravated robbery instruction, which were instructions 13, 14, and 17 in the jury packet, all correctly reflected the law of felony murder, robbery, and aggravated robbery, as has been endorsed by divisions of this court and the Supreme Court, and upheld as adequately tracking the statute.
Okay, could we stay on that point for just a moment?
Sure.
Do you, first of all, do you agree, and it wasn't clear to me from your brief, does the intent to commit the underlying felony have to precede the killing?
I'm not sure the law is fully clear on that here in Colorado, but Braxton unambiguously held, and I'm going to read the quote so I don't completely butcher it, we hold as a matter of law, the sequence of events is irrelevant as long as sufficient evidence is produced to show that a felony was committed.
I think there's no dispute that the sequence of events is irrelevant, but I really want to focus on when that intent to commit the underlying felony has to be formed. We've got cases that sort of talk about it, inferentially talk about it. We've got Bruce Pringle's treatise saying that it is the law in Colorado that the intent has to precede the killing. So I guess I just wanted to know if you were willing to take a position, yes or no, on this.
I'm going to take the position that the intent in this case, it was there that he intended to rob Mr. Frazier at the time that he pulled a gun on him in the truck and then shot him and then took the money at the end.
But you would agree that the jury was never so instructed that it had to find that the intent preceded.
But I'm not sure there was there's a requirement in Colorado that that sort of instruction has to be given. And I don't think that the facts of this case or even the jury question that was sent out in this case suggested that they were having a problem with that. So, as this court knows, the gravamen, I'm quoting from People versus Jones, which I also cite in my brief, the gravamen of robbery is that force is used to take the application of physical force or intimidation against the victim at any time during the course of the robbery. But Jones also says unambiguously that the force used to take does not have to be concomitant or taken at the same time as when you actually relieve the person. There's no requirement that the application of force or intimidation must be virtually contemporaneous. What the evidence showed here was that Mr. Walden put a gun up against the victim's clothing, whether it was his bare skin or his shirt, and then shot him twice. He struggled out of the car. Mr. Walden shot him twice more in the back when he was on the ground, and then he jumped out and took his money. This was all a very quick little transaction. There were the other two people who followed them, and he jumped out and grabbed it and ran. We can look at it under a cold microscope of, there was other money, there were other drugs in the car, but that doesn't change the fact that he had just taken the money that he just saw Mr. Frazier receive in exchange for marijuana from the other two individuals. And this is a 19-year-old man who had previously stolen from Mr. Frazier, and he didn't have a job and was selling marijuana on the side. So there might have been other money, but at the same time, once you shoot somebody in broad daylight, you do the best you can with the plan that you had beforehand. His plan beforehand had been to rob him, and putting a gun up against a person's chest, a person's body, is highly suggestive that he wasn't just doing this on a whim or he wasn't doing it in self-defense. And we know that the jury rejected the self-defense idea. And that rejection of self-defense is mutually exclusive of the idea that this was an accidental shooting or one that was made without any sort of forethought before that. What we're really looking at here is we're looking at whether the jury instructions as given, so the original ones, 13, 14, and 17, I believe it is, convey the law here in Colorado. And they do. They've been upheld, as I mentioned repeatedly, Jones, Braxton, Cottrell, and Phillips most recently. And Phillips is a very resourceful case for this court to determine this, because Phillips essentially said that a close temporal and spatial relationship exists between the felony and the death, as here, then that intent to kill has to be inferred, because otherwise you're just you're almost breaking it down too minutely and giving the deference away from, in suspicions purposes, away from the prosecution. What we have here is we have a question of whether additional instructions would have been necessary, and as this court knows, you review that under an extremely deferential abuse of discretion standard. And that's even more so here, where the defendant never once requested a timing instruction. And that's very key, because under a plain error standard, it's very hard to have an error be plain and an error be obvious, where there is no published case in Colorado saying that timing must be an element. And in fact, we have a case just the opposite, the Braxton case, saying that the sequence of events is irrelevant so long as the underlying intent to commit the felony exists. And the error is not obvious, it can't be plain, and it can't rise to the level of reversal being necessary. The instructions also said that in order to convict a robbery and an aggravated robbery, the defendant has to have created a knowing conduct of putting the gun against him and knowing that he was causing intent and bodily harm, and the jury found that. Regardless of what question it sent out, it was asking what the order of events was, but the order of events didn't change the fact that it found that the defendant knowingly used force and took money from the defendant, or from the victim, excuse me. Judge Randy, looks like you have a question.
No, I'm listening.
Oh, pardon me then. The defendant never requested a theory of defense instruction, which was to say, the self-defense he requested, but he's not challenging that on appeal, but he never requested an instruction saying, I just impulsively took it. He argued that in closing arguments, that information was before the jury, but it's very hard, again, to find plain error if, in fact, the defendant never has suggested, I was entitled to an instruction on this matter. And I believe the recent division of this court actually found similarly, albeit an unpublished case, so I'm just going to push that off to the side. There was no instruction from the defendant asking the court to address when he needed to form the intent. To the contrary, the prosecution said the intent can be formed any time, and the court said we don't need to give that instruction because that instruction is already correctly encompassed within the jury instructions. And again, those are the instructions that have been held sufficient by this court and by the Supreme Court for the past three decades. Phillips, I think, is very applicable in this case, as is to a certain extent Cottrell and Braxton, because those all talk about a murder with a subsequent theft or robbery or felony that then imputed the intent for that felony murder back to the murder. Phillips dealt with the defendant who shot his neighbor and then went inside and robbed his apartment. And we have something very similar here. We have a defendant who got in the victim's car, shot him, and then rooted around, stole his money, and then ran.
But in Phillips, wouldn't you agree that the issue there was sufficiency of the evidence and not adequacy of the jury instructions, and yet the division then went through the facts and was satisfied that there was evidence that intent had been formed before or concurrently with the killing. In other words, it seems to me Phillips implicitly recognizes the principle the defendant is urging here.
But that's also under a sufficiency claim. And under a sufficiency claim, as here you have to look at it in the light most favorable to the prosecution, and that light most favorable to the prosecution is the evidence, and I laid out in my brief, I don't have the page number off the top of my head, but it talks about how the coroner said there were four individually fatal shots, which means Mr. Walton aimed, fired, and intended to kill each of these four shots, including two shots in the back after the victim fell out of his truck. And he put the gun up against the victim's body, which is, and certainly in the light of most favorable prosecution, is completely anathema to an accidental shooting. I'm trying to remember if it was Cottrell or Braxton that talked about, I believe it was Cottrell that talked about a defendant who killed the victim and then stole his wallet and keys. That has the exact same indicia of a sort of incidental theft after the fact as this potentially could. And that court rejected that idea. And I guess that would lead to Braxton as being the one where the defendant broke in and then maybe staged a robbery afterwards to suggest that it had been an accidental killing that was in the middle of it. Again, that was under the felony murder doctrine, that intent is imputed back to the actual killing itself. And again, I would remind the overall theme of all the felony murder cases out of this court is that it's a very broad application. It's intended to net dangerous behavior that results in the untimely death of a victim, as here, who was caught in the crossfires of another felon. And again, as here, and I won't get this court about the head of it, but I've gone through the sufficiency claims and the evidence that supports a sufficiency determination. And that's exactly what the felony murder doctrine is trying to encompass in its reach. If there are no further questions on that, I'm happy to take questions on either the third or the fourth issue. With respect to the fourth issue, at this point, I think that's been relatively well established under Supreme Court and People versus Moore. One of the things we talked about in the briefs was the need potentially for a remand hearing. That's no longer the remedy. The remedy at this point is just not to consider the issue and to let it go for a post-conviction motion.
Mr. Michaels, one question on the expertise or the outside expertise of the jury foreperson.
Sure.
I understand your position that he used his professional expertise to talk about the sequence of gunshots, but what about his opining on the first degree and second degree penalties? Why is that not outside the record?
Well, there are two different things about that. First of all, it's just basically a basic matter of common sense that a crime of a higher culpability than one of a lower culpability is going to net a sentence that has more prison terms. He didn't come out and say, look, he's going to face life imprisonment versus he's going to face 48 years in prison if we just give him secondary murder. He has said a higher degree of crime is going to deal with a higher degree of punishment. And secondly, under People versus Holt, which I believe I said in my brief, that's a 606B issue. So it's beyond consideration anyway because it involves delving into jury deliberations. There's no suggestion that this particular juror, this juror foreperson, went outside and said, hey, look, I researched the Colorado criminal statutes on sentencing. They're a great read. I think we should all read it. And here are what the sentences are. He said, this crime, a higher crime means a higher punishment. So I would say it's part of 606B, first and foremost. And even if it's not extraneous information, and certainly it would fail the second prong of the 606B exception, that there's no way it could have prejudiced the defendant. At most, it would have inured to his benefit because if there were any jurors thinking about whether or not to convict him of first degree murder, then that might have given them pause. Otherwise, I would suggest that the holding in the Supreme Court of Kendrick versus Pittman's pretty much covers that issue. If there are no further questions, I would ask that this court affirm all Wallace convictions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Michaels. Ms. Renner, you have about 6.5 minutes.
Okay. I would like to talk about the Cottrell and also the Bolden case that I cited in my brief. And the Bolden case actually specifically is a situation like here where the jury received stock instructions and they received a question from the jury asking about, and it said, if it is determined that a robbery was in fact committed, does this necessarily imply previous intent to commit a robbery? So asking about the intent necessary for felony murder. And what the court found in Bolden is that perhaps had there not been that question, the stock instructions might have been sufficient. But here, when the court refused to do anything more than refer the jury back to the instructions that had been given, that could well have left the jury with the incorrect impression that coincidence was sufficient to convict. And that's it's the same situation that we have here. It's not sufficient that there was a killing act and a theft for felony murder liability to lie. Cottrell is probably the closest factually. In that case, there was a killing act and then the man was stabbed, and then the defendant took the person's car and keys. And the argument there was that the jury had not been sufficiently instructed that they had to find intent to commit robbery either prior to or concurrent with the Killing Act. And in that case, the jury also asked a question there, and the court found that the instructions that were given were sufficient, and what defense counsel had asked for in that case was only giving of an instruction that they had tendered previously that the court had rejected, but it was not that intent. It's not the instruction that I think should have been given, that the jury must find intent to commit the robbery either prior to or concurrent with the Killing Act. But the court noted that all the defense counsel asked for was this prior instruction. And here we have the defense counsel also asking for further clarification that the force being used has to be used to effect the taking, and that ties into an intent to rob. So I think that Cottrell is distinguishable because we were asking here for something further that would require the jury to find some intent to use this physical force to take the $100 off the floor.
Ms. Rinna, I'm a few pages behind you in your argument, I'm afraid, but you began your this portion of your argument with a cite to, was it Bolden?
Bolden.
And I'm
embarrassed to say I didn't remember that case.
Yeah, looking it's one of the cases where I talk about the majority of you being...
All right. Thank you. Okay. Yes.
It's page 21.
Thank you. I see. I was looking under people, and that was not.
And I guess, and Your Honor had asked earlier about whether the intent must precede, and I don't think that that is what I've been arguing. I don't think that's what the majority view is either. It doesn't have to precede. I mean, it can precede, but also can be concurrent with the Killing Act. And I guess the other thing I was going to mention about Cottrell is that also Cottrell, there was not a sufficiency argument made in that case that I am making here, and I think the evidence is insufficient here to establish that Mr. Walden intended to rob Mr. Frazier either prior to or at the time that he killed him. Putting the gun against his chest, maybe in another case that might be sufficient, or might be some evidence that you could draw a reasonable inference of an intent to rob, perhaps, but not in this case. They're in very close quarters inside a truck. I don't think, based on the evidence that we have here, Mr. Walden described a situation where he was adjusting his gun. He knew Mr. Frazier had a gun. He was a drug dealer. He was carrying this gun because he was afraid for his life. He knew this was dangerous business to be buying drugs. And he also knew that he had stolen from Mr. Frazier's truck previously. He had not robbed him, but he had stolen from him previously. So he knew that Mr. Frazier was armed, and Mr. Frazier apparently made a move when Mr. Walden made a move with his gun. And so in that close proximity, it's really not unreasonable to think that the gun would come up against his chest, you know, accidentally or in that fast movement, and that you can't really draw any reasonable inference that this shows an intent to rob. And that's what I believe I've distinguished Phillips in the reply brief. I mean, Phillips is a case where there is substantially more evidence of an intent to rob after he shoots the victim in that case, and then plows through the house and at gunpoint asks, where are the drugs, where are the money, where's the money? He doesn't get anything, but then he shoots that person as well. Clearly from those set of facts, there is an intent to rob that just isn't present in this case. And I guess if the court doesn't have any further questions, I would ask the court to vacate Mr. Walden's felony murder conviction, also the aggravated robbery conviction, or in the alternative, reverse it for a new trial. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Meyer. Thank you again, Mr. Michaels. Thanks to the counsel for your excellent arguments this afternoon. I think they were helpful to the court. The matter is being submitted, and you can expect a written opinion to issue in due course.